Friday, everybody. Hope your holidays have gone well or are going well. This is Tom Dotan here, reporting to you from Information HQ, a sparsely populated Information HQ. Many folks are away for the holiday or working remotely, but we're still here bringing you the great content that you expect from our podcast. Here's what we've got for you this episode. I'm talking to Jessica Tunkel, my media reporter counterpart out in New York, where we talk about her predictions for 2020. She had some thoughts on what one of the most closely held traditions in the entertainment industry, the movie window, what is in store for that in 2020. Spoiler, things are going to change. One of the most closely held traditions may be going by the wayside. And then I'm talking to Kevin McLaughlin about Databricks, AWS, and open source, and why the CEO of one of AWS's competitors is not getting on board with the current state of criticism that people in the open source community are levying at Amazon and AWS. It was a fun conversation too. All right, we're all a little bit sluggish after the holiday, but still have a great episode for you. Here is my conversation with Jessica Tunkel. All right, very excited to have on the line here Jessica Tunkel, media reporter out in New York, and in a very special post-holiday edition of the Information's 411. And we're going to talk about predictions, our favorite year-end tradition. Jessica, how are you? How are things?
Things are good. How are you doing? Did you have a good holiday?
I had a great holiday. I was out with the family. I'm now kind of winnowing down my list of New Year's resolutions, hopefully coming down to a solid 10. By early next year. How are you? How was your holiday?
Good. I'm catching up on all the streaming shows that I haven't gotten to watch. Just started the morning show, which I'm enjoying so far.
That's right. Yeah, sleeper hit. It got really kind of negative reviews at first, and then seemed to like. I don't know. I guess the show gets better as it goes along.
I think it definitely gets better. I mean, I personally think it got unfairly panned because people wanted to pan it because it's Apple. But There is definitely that element of, you know, in the first episode, there's a whole conversation about how technology companies are going to destroy broadcast news, which seems a bit self-serving, as well as the large, you know, shots of the iPhone in the first scene.
That was as far as I got into this show. A few scenes and just seeing very in-focus shots of people's iPhones. I realized what was up. Although I think it sounds like the show does move beyond just iPhones, right?
Yeah, no, it definitely gets better. I think the acting is very strong and the storyline is great. I mean, if you're like us, like obsessed with all things media, you know, it's a fascinating story and it's fun to watch because, you know, we know this story, we know what it's based on. So It's just kind of fun to see how they play it out.
Right. And I think it just sort of in closing on that topic, I wonder if Apple maybe regretted their rollout approach with that show, because I think they gave critics just a couple of episodes. They didn't give them like full binge option with it. And it could just be that the show got better as time went on and the early reviews were negative because the show just wasn't as good then.
And isn't that such a quintessential like rookie mistake, right? Like they're new to this and That's, you know, that's a learning thing.
Right.
I mean, I'd be interested. I don't know. How was it technically for you watching it?
Actually, I'm a great example of maybe what Apple was trying to do with this, because I was on the bus and had a moment and I was like, oh, maybe I'll just watch this show. And so I had it on my phone and began streaming it just directly on my phone while on the bus. And it actually worked great. It queued up pretty quickly. There wasn't a lot of lag. The picture quality was good. So are you saying it wasn't that great for you?
It was overall fine. There was two strange things that happened. Well, one strange thing and one annoying thing. The strange thing was it kept going into subtitle mode and we kept having to turn it off.
It's like watching with my parents. They always put subtitles on.
And in English. The second thing was I don't like having to watch the recap of the episode before. Like there's no way to skip that. Mm-hmm. When you're watching the next episode, I like to just be able to skip it and jump the next episode. And I actually heard from a source this week that that's something Warner Media is also discussing, how they're going to deal with HBO Max. I think right now in the beta, you can't skip through the next episode. You can't skip through the recap.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting. It's like these little, you know, when everyone has like five or six streaming services, these kinds of little things might be make or break for some of these companies.
Yeah, and it's totally an area where Netflix has an advantage because they've been doing this for so long and have kind of calibrated their service to a point that people just have an expectation of what a good video streaming service can do. And like Disney at first got slammed when Disney Plus came out because they didn't have the ability to, I mean, this is pretty bad. I think this was actually just a software issue, but if you stopped an episode in the middle and then returned to it, it would go back to the beginning. Now, obviously that's unacceptable. I mean, you can't have a streaming service that does that, but I think there are other kind of little niceties and like tech advantages that we've just come to expect that, yeah, you've got to meet that bar. Cause if you're not, you look lame. You look really well.
But, you know, to that end, though, what I found with Disney Plus, my son was watching some sort of Lego show, and it stopped after the episode. And it was, you know, the room was quiet, and I looked up, and I was like, right. Oh, the episode stopped because it was over. It didn't go into the next episode. And I loved that because I will forget that he's watching TV and then it'll be like an hour later.
Right. That goes both ways. I'm assuming for long-term subscriber retention, you got to keep them hooked. You got to just shove more content at them. So let's talk about our predictions that yours came out this week. Mine, I believe, will be coming out next week. So I don't mind spoiling it, though. That's fine. but it looks at both of us, you know, obviously write about media and looks sort of at some of the big changes that we expect to see happen next year, or kind of how the investments that were made this year, how they're maybe going to pay off next year. But let's start off with yours, because you basically looked at one of the oldest, most tightly kept, important traditions in the media world. Well, I guess maybe in the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years, which is the window, the theatrical window, which, why don't you explain to people what a theatrical window is?
So traditionally, a studio has to put a movie out in theaters around, right now it's somewhere between 70 or 90 days. It's kind of been shortening as years go by. But they have to the movie has to exclusively be in movie theaters for that period of time before it could then go on another service.
Yeah, home entertainment or
home entertainment, you know, DVDs, home entertainment, you know, HBO, something like that. That has been, you know, there's been a push and pull forever on this, right? So the studios say, their big complaint is, we spend a lot of marketing on these movies, and if they're duds in the theaters, we want to be able to get them out and monetize them, like get them into, you know, on DVD or on HBO. We want to be able to, like, or right now on streaming services, to see if we can kind of make up some of that money and maybe get some more viewers through other means. But yeah, so they feel like they're just spending a lot of money on the marketing of the theatrical release and then nothing when it comes out on home entertainment. The theaters, one thing that was interesting is the theaters, the bulk of their revenue actually comes from concessions, mm-hmm. not from the tickets themselves.
Right. It's a nice factoid you can bust out at the dinner table if you want to tell people that. But yeah, no, it's your buying of popcorns and candy and also those loyalty program things that they all do now. That's the real moneymaker. They're essentially like convenience stores that happen to also show movies.
Exactly. So they have a huge amount to lose, and they're fighting back saying, if you shorten this window, we're going to go out of business.
Right.
So, but I mean, it's all changed now, right? Like, you're seeing Netflix put a movie out. You know, The Irishman was in theater, 2 weeks?
But that was, that was also just a formality. I mean, that's a...
Well, right, exactly. Yeah. But it's still happening, right? Like, it's a different entity. Right. But it's still happening. And people are just thinking about all of these things differently now, right? Mm-hmm. So, and all these companies are launching streaming services. Disney has Disney Plus. Comcast owns Universal, which is coming out in NBC, which is coming out with Peacock next year. And Warner Media is coming out with HBO Max. So they all need to do something to increase subscribers to their service. Right. And the best way to do that is movies.
Right. Right. Totally. Yeah. I think what you're getting at with your thing, which I find so interesting, is that what we are seeing in, you know, the possibility of them shortening these windows is just the changing priorities of these media companies. It used to be that movies were the alpha and omega of their output, and you know, the successful box office is really what powers your earnings and your pride, frankly. And now that they're seeing, you know, the movie, you know, box offices have been flat to down, They're certainly making fewer and fewer movies, as the years go on, that maybe using these properties as a way to power your streaming service is more important than, you know, having just a huge opening box office if you can't get it.
And if you, I don't know if you remember this, but HBO.
I'm very young, so maybe not.
Yeah. Well, this is not that. This is like a few years ago, years ago.
Okay, so, go ahead.
But HBO. I don't know if this changed when AT&T bought the company, but HBO historically, like 70% of their viewership has been movies.
Yep, totally.
Like, so I mean, it's a big driver. What I found fascinating about kind of reporting out this prediction is that it seems like such a no-brainer to so many people, and people are like, "Of course, that's going to happen." But some people are very, and I'm not talking about like the theater owners. I'm talking about entertainment executives are like vehemently against this idea.
Mm-hmm. And what's their reasoning for it? I mean, why do they see it as such a bad move?
Just that it's been going on for so long that it will never change.
Right, right.
I'm not saying theaters are going to go away. Mm-hmm. I think there will always be a place to go to the movie theaters, but I think you'll go to the movie theaters to see like the movies you need to see on that huge big screen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the awards movies.
Right. And I mean, you've already seen that taking place over the last few years. If you look at the number of movies that come out on a year-to-year basis, it's been going down. And the movies that are really promoted are these giant blockbuster franchise things. And it's the theatrical experience, right? It's like you go, you know, they want to make it an event because they realize that the alternative is very compelling, which is staying at home and watching a pretty good movie or TV show.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you have companies like AT&T getting into the entertainment industry, and they, you know, AT&T doesn't really care about the way things have been done in the past. They just want to figure out how they're going to make the most money.
Yeah. The other thing that's kind of interesting about it, and I'm wondering if when you were putting this together, you thought much or chatted with people about, is like, if you're an actor or a producer, I mean, how do you feel about that? I mean, do you like the idea, or sorry, are you on board with the idea of, you know, my theatrical window and my time as a big screen star is just shorter now than it would have been a couple of years ago?
It's such an interesting question. I think it actually might depend on the streaming service. Like, we've written about this before, right? Like, some talent would prefer to be on Netflix over, you know,
right,
HBO Max, which they don't know what it is. I mean, I'm giving that as an example. Hulu, that's a better example. Most people, you know, we've heard of that, of talent saying, I'd rather be on Netflix than Hulu.
Right, right. Yeah, that's the funny thing about Netflix, too, is that I think it may not seem as big because there aren't the big screen, you know, big marketing campaigns behind a movie, but the distribution is enormous. I mean, if you believe the numbers, and I guess we should, from Netflix about the number of people watching things like The Irishman or whatever, it's a lot of people.
So exactly.
You're getting out there.
Exactly.
All right, Jessica. Well, it looks like we'll probably have to check back in with each other at the end of the year and see how well we did.
But okay, I'll talk to you then.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for joining.
Take care. Bye. Bye.
So I feel like recently in the news, Kevin, AWS has gotten a lot more play in its relationship to open source and criticisms by some people, some companies, about how they are utilizing open source and potentially violating the spirit of that technology. And this kind of came up in your conversation with the CEO of Databricks, who had a very particular take on this, but also his company has maybe a slightly different approach. But before we get to Databricks, I want to hear from you. If you could, to summarize, what exactly is the conversation right now about AWS and open source?
So some commercial open source companies like MongoDB and Elastic, both of which are the managers of open source software projects, and they also use that software in commercial services, they feel that AWS has an unfair advantage by being able to take the free software that they manage and then use it as the underpinning of an AWS cloud service, which AWS then plugs into all of its other cloud services and ultimately makes its service very competitive with what the open source companies are selling. And so AWS isn't doing anything illegal here. This is more of like an ethical argument.
Right.
Like some people or some of the proponents of open source feel that AWS is doing nothing wrong. Others feel that, it's not right for the dominant cloud provider to be using free software in this way to kind of further its dominance.
Right. Okay. So where does Databricks land on all of this? I mean, where, and you interviewed its CEO, Ali Ghodsi.
I did. So the interesting thing about Ali's view was that Databricks doesn't see AWS as a threat. And he was very adamant about that. Our interview happened a couple of weeks before the New York Times story came out, which sort of shed more light on this debate and also was controversial for a number of different reasons, which I won't get into. But yeah, he was expecting the question. And the question was, how do you feel about AWS? And he said, not only do we not see them as a competitor, we actually emulate their model in terms of Databricks doesn't sell software that runs in data centers except for government customers because they have to. It's very focused on selling everything through the cloud, really just kind of following the model that AWS laid down more than a decade ago.
Interesting. And the company has grown substantially in the last year or so even, right?
Yes. So Databricks has had two major rounds of funding this year, somewhere around $600 million, both of them led by Andreessen Horowitz. Its valuation was $2.75 billion in February, and then in October, that rose to $6.2 billion. So pretty good year for them.
Yeah, huge business too. So what exactly does Databricks do? And I mean, why were they interesting to you?
So Databricks is kind of, I think the reason why they've had such a really huge valuation increase this year is because they're kind of at the confluence of two trends. One is data analytics, which is nothing new. I mean, that's been around for several years now, where companies want to be able to get business insights from their corporate data. And so that it does that. And then it also is a sort of open source form of machine learning, which is kind of a new market in the cloud, but obviously one that has significant potential, and pretty much, you know, every tech company under the sun is looking to that as a big opportunity. So yeah, Databricks is kind of, that's their multiplier, I think, is that they're actually like, they've got two potentially long-term businesses.
Right. And so who are their chief competitors?
Well, they certainly compete with Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, all of which offer cloud machine learning and data analytics. They compete with, you know, a number of other companies that are more specifically focused on data analytics. But the market for what Databricks does is so large and so in some ways so new that there's a lot of room for them to grow. And I think that's why investors are
so excited. How does, you know, Ali end up being a competitor, running a company that's a, like you say, a competitor to Amazon, and yet doesn't seem to find anything problematic with the way they manage, you know, open source?
Well, it's interesting because AWS actually does have a service that is compatible with Apache Spark, which is one of the open source projects that Databricks manages. And it is very much an alternative to Databricks for the data analytics piece. But I really don't know the answer to that question, but I think that he's just decided that, hey, we're not going to be part of this chorus of companies that are complaining about unfair behavior, because quite frankly, there are a lot of people in the open source community who feel that AWS really is actually quite positive for open source in terms of being able to extend it to a broader range of customers.
Yeah. I mean, where do you fall on all this? You obviously spend so much time speaking to people in the space and developing your own opinions on, you know, how all of this is run and the ethics of, if this is an ethical argument, you know, what the right approach would be. I mean, what's your take?
I can see both sides. I know that's kind
okay.
of a wishy-washy
that's
answer.
Kevin.
Well, on one hand, you can say that, you know, AWS, you know, they're not violating any rules, but certainly if you're MongoDB and or, you know, if you're Elastic and you see AWS not only creating a version of your service that's sort of based on the free software you offer, but then extending that and creating what is in some circles considered an alternative version of Elastic with AWS specific features, you can understand how they could be frustrated. On the other hand, I kind of lean in the direction of, I think what is upsetting to some of these companies is that AWS is so dominant and right. has so many customers, and no one can fault them for getting out to a multi-year head start.
Mm-hmm. And the bigger companies that provide competitive services like Microsoft or Google, have any of them expressed any frustration around this or less so?
I should have mentioned this before. Actually, Databricks has a very close relationship with Microsoft. They have a joint service that allows Databricks software to run on Microsoft's Azure cloud. So they're very closely aligned with Microsoft as well. They don't yet have a formal relationship with Google, although Ali did tell me that they've talked to Google and a number of other providers in the past. But right now, it's all about Microsoft and AWS for Databricks. And I would imagine if their business continues to grow that at some point they would also look to partner with other providers.
Interesting. All right, Kevin, thanks for joining.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, very excited to have my media counterpart in New York, Jessica Tunkel, on the line here in this very special post-holiday special of the Information's 411. Jessica,
what's up? Sorry.
Is it Martin? Does he want to be in the podcast? Is
that Does he want to be in the podcast? Because we're doing the podcast. I don't know. Why don't you come on and you can talk about it too? I don't know. We're just talking about our predictions. Okay, let me call you back because I'm actually doing it right now and this is recording. Bye.
There you have it, Information listeners. Live on air, we have a call from our editor browbeating us for not responding to his phone calls. I'm sure this is highly urgent. All right, you want to start over?
Yeah, let's start over.
Okay. I'm going to keep this audio though.